Grendel's Coffee House. And now here we will take you to Economic Update with Richard Wolff.
One of these days, things ain't gonna change. One of these days.
Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program exploring the economic aspects of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, our hopes for the future, our hopes for the jobs our children may be able to get. My name is Richard Wolff. I'm the host of Economic Update. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and currently I teach at the New School University in New York City. I also write columns for truthout.org, a remarkable independent source of news and analysis that I urge you to check out, truthout.org. Let me begin with a piece of what I think is good news. It's not that often that we have that in looking at the economic realities we face these days around the world. But on Thursday, a week ago, roughly, the Rhode Island Senate passed a remarkable bill. And in this bill, the Rhode Island Senate said that in state contracts, that is when the state of Rhode Island buys everything from paper clips to road materials to computers, preference will be given to firms that pay their executives less than 32 times their lowest employees' pay. Well, let's be clear. The Rhode Island Senate is sending a message, and I will actually quote the state senator, Catherine Kuhl Rumsey by name, who made the following remark. She said, "This bill is a statement of our values. State contracts," she said, "shouldn't be rewarding firms that pay workers poorly and CEOs excessively." Wow. And to put this in context, consider that average large corporation CEOs in the United States currently earn between 250 and 350 times the lowest paid workers in their enterprises. That's research that's been confirmed by many different examinations. At the other end, consider the best known and largest worker co-op in the world, the Mondragon Corporation in Spain. They have a rule, not mandated by law, but a rule that has governed that co-op since its inception, that the highest paid worker cannot earn more than 8.5 times the lowest paid worker's income. So from the worker co-op, 8.5 times, to what the Rhode Island Senate thinks is the minimum, or rather the maximum acceptable, 32 times, to the average large corporation in this country, 300 times. You get a sense of this. But it's a remarkable step taken by the Rhode Island Senate, and I wanted to make sure folks knew about it, especially if they thought about reproducing that in their own states. Well, the Rhode Island example of trying to do something in the nature of limiting the high pay of executives, so it's only 32 times the lowest worker rather than the typical in large corporations in America, the typical 350. That takes us to yet another update, and this has to do with struggles in the United States Congress over the Dodd-Frank Act. You know, that financial reform passed during this terrible recession a few years ago. One of the things that act called for was it required corporations, larger ones, to post publicly what the ratio is between what they pay their highest and what they pay their lowest employees. It was felt that this is a basic commitment to transparency, to letting the people of the United States know what the situation is so that they can take whatever steps they believe to be appropriate. Well, this has been delayed. Surprise, surprise. This requirement of the law has been postponed. And the leading cause of that are lobbying efforts by large corporations and by their mouthpieces, such as the United States Chambers of Commerce. And I thought you'd be interested in the arguments that they make. And I didn't make this up, folks. The chamber says it would be very difficult, very costly, and very complicated to tabulate the information, to do all the research to suggest and to figure out what the highest paid person in their company and what the lowest paid person gets. Several staff members of the Securities and Exchange Commission, among others, have countered by suggesting that they wouldn't have to check every single worker's pay. They could just take a reasonable sample among those who they know are toward the bottom and that one at the top whose salary they know. But between you and me and the lamppost, suggesting that we have to postpone this provision, which they all opposed because of the difficulty of measuring it, is what we would call in every other situation a stretch. Next budget item, next update is a budget item. The United States budget, it was announced by the government, has been reduced. The government is not running as much red ink as it was before. It's not spending as much more than it is taking in. And this, we were told, was good news. Well, it kind of is good news. You know who it's good news for? The creditors of the United States. Those wealthy individuals, corporations, and foreign governments who have done the bulk of the lending to the United States government. They want to make sure they get paid back and they get paid their interest. And so they like to see a government that is not building up its debts too quickly the way we were. So they're pleased. But let's take a look at the economics involved here. The government announced that revenues were rising 7% higher in this latest period than they had been a year ago. Okay, let's be clear. What does that mean? That means more money is coming out of the private economy, 7% more than it used to. That's money which, had it been left in the hands of most people, would have been spent on goods and services. Those are taxes, mostly paid by individuals, mostly, who now cannot spend that money because they gave it to the government. Well, you might say, that would be okay in terms of its impact on jobs and incomes if the money that was given to the government, the 7% more, was turned around and spent by the government so that the demand for goods and services and therefore the jobs to produce them would be maintained. But that's not what's happening. The government is taking 7% more of the money of the public out of their hands, but it announced with great pride that it is spending 2% less than it used to. Okay, folks, you don't need rocket science here. If the government is taking money out of the private economy at a 7% bigger clip than before, but spending, not only not spending that extra 7%, but actually spending 2% less than before, then what the government is taking is not being replaced by what the government is spending. On the contrary, the government is making the problem worse. The government is buying 2% less goods and services. It's making it impossible for people to buy as many goods and services as before by taxing them more. End result, the economy we have, the recovery that isn't working very well, that doesn't affect most people. The government, by its improving and reducing its deficit, is making the economic conditions for most Americans worse than they would otherwise be if the government wasn't so busy doing what its creditors want and instead was doing what its people need. Fourth update for this morning. This has to do with Detroit. I come back to Detroit because it is the future of the United States if we don't make massive basic changes in our economy. It's a city, again, to remind you, that was the center of a thriving, efficient, world-class capitalist manufacturing center back in the 60s, even into the 70s. the place where automobiles were produced, the place where Motown music emerged to change the way the world understands and enjoys music, and so on. It had a population of almost 2 million. Today it has a population of 700,000. The majority of the people driven out of the city, which is now abandoned in large parts of it, which is seriously considering, as I have reported, destroying 40,000 dilapidated properties and perhaps much more. A city in bankruptcy. A city that suggests what can happen if you permit private corporations simply to leave to make more money, to leave behind the disaster of what happens when private enterprises build up an industry and then abandon the people that have come there to work there, often brought there by those companies, begged by those companies to come, recruited by those companies to come, even after the cities and states have given these companies enormous subsidies. They can get up, and they do, and leave, and they do, to make more profits for their shareholders, and they do, and they leave behind unemployed people, broken families, destroyed and bankrupt cities. New statistics I want to share with you now. And this comes from a report by the Bloomberg Financial Services on June 11th. Detroit has a greater proportion of babies that die in the first year of their life, this is called infant mortality, than the following countries: China, Mexico, Thailand, and Saudi Arabia. That's right. Conditions in that city have deteriorated to the point where they have worse infant mortality than those countries. Wow. Pregnancy-related deaths, women whose complications lead to them dying as part of their pregnancy, put Michigan in the bottom one-fifth of all the states in the United States where that, for that statistic. Nationwide in this country, according to the U.S. Census, 22% of children live in poverty. In Detroit, it is 60%. All of this reported in Bloomberg Financial News. Life expectancy is lower for adults in Detroit than in any of the other top 25 metropolitan areas of the United States. There really is nothing in the way of a comment I could make adequate to describe the human costs of permitting fundamental economic decisions like the location of production to be made not in terms of what's important for the millions of people who depend on those location decisions, but instead to be done for the tiny minority of people whose wealth depends on where location of production is made. The morality of capitalism is one of its chief failures and weaknesses. We will turn now, as we often do, to a larger topic, one that you have asked me to analyze and to present you with material to think about as you deal with this economic reality. I want to talk now about the economics of advertising. What do I mean by advertising? All the things that go into persuading you, the customer, the buyer, the consumer, the working person, to spend your money. It can be a billboard along the highway. It can be a television program interrupted by showing you somebody acting out that they enjoy a product. It can be the wrapping around a product that is designed to get you to buy it. It's all the different ways we are, all of us in modern society, bombarded every hour of the day through countless media with messages designed to get us to part with our money one way or another. Millions of people have jobs doing this work. These are people who would otherwise be unemployed, that's one possibility, or people who would otherwise be devoting their energy, their craft, their skills, their ideas for other purposes. I don't know, making life better for people one way or another. Improving the beauty of our schools, improving the quality of our care for elderly folk, enhancing the output of ingenious new products to help. They're not doing all those other things. Instead, they're spending their time, their energy, their educational capabilities on persuading us to buy this kind of soap rather than another. That kind of soup rather than another. That car rather than another. And let's take a look at this. First, there is built into this industry a fundamental irrationality. Here's how it works. Suppose there are, oh, just for the sake of argument, a dozen different producers of a kind of shirt. They go along producing their different shirts. You find them in the shirt stores, and you choose among them those which please you the most. End of story. But now, one company seeks to gain an advantage over the others. And it fills the highway, and it fills the buses with posters showing wonderfully happy people, maybe celebrities of one kind or another, wearing their shirt. And these celebrities are scripted to say, I am so happy with my X shirt that I would be advising all my friends and you there in the public not to buy Y brand shirt, but to join me in the happiness of X brand. All that this does is force all of the other companies to also begin to advertise. Not to gain an advantage over the first one, but simply not to gain the disadvantage that their brand seems somehow not to be in the air the way the brand is that is advertised. So we force everybody to spend huge amounts of money advertising, even if they otherwise wouldn't have, the minute one producer of anything decides to do it. So the size of advertising goes crazy, as it has around the world, the minute one competitor tries to do it. That means much more in the way of resources is spent than any rational decision of how to use resources would make us do as a people. And of course, in the end, it all nets out. You get confused, you really don't care anymore because too many brands have spent too much time persuading you with arguments you probably didn't believe in the first place. So what you're confronting is an endless display of competitive advertising costing a fortune. And remember, the companies that have to do all this self-negating, self-canceling advertising all have one thing in common. They must raise the price of what they produce to pay for the advertising. So the shirt you buy is not costing you the money it takes to get the cloth, to have the tailor make the shirt, to make the nice design on it. It includes the cost they have, the companies that make the shirts, to advertise. Wow. That means you pay, in the end, the cost of all of those companies' silly efforts to beat one another by persuading you to buy brand X rather than brand Y. Did anyone ever ask you whether you want to pay for all that advertising? No. That's the way capitalism works. Your role as a consumer in this system is to pay even for the most irrational expenditures that this system itself imposes on producers. And last thing about advertising, which is about its economics, but also goes beyond that. If you flood the airwaves, if you flood the highway billboards, if you flood the packaging on everything that we confront in every store we enter, in any store window we look at, if you confront us endlessly with messages to buy, you're also confronting the mass of people with a peculiarly imbalanced set of influences. In other words, we're constantly told that we will be prettier, happier, more successful in our relationships, better beloved, if we buy this, if we wear that, if we have a vacation house over there, if we eat in this sort of way, these foods, that place. We're constantly told in a capitalist system obsessed with advertising, as almost all of them now are, we're constantly told a very important message that happiness, success, love, all the basic needs of a human being are available by buying something. Now, is there a comparable effort to teach us that there are other ways of building relationships, other ways of finding love, that have to do with how we interact with one another, that have to do with how we think about one another, with how we approach one another as human beings working together, living together, enjoying sports together, whatever? No, there's no comparable system of messages all day long about how to understand your child better, how to be a better parent. Sure, there are some places you can go, but it has nothing to do, nothing comparable to the advertising which drowns out all the other ways to cope with life and keeps focusing us on buying objects as the way to do it. Thoughtful people have understood long ago that you can think about this with an interesting phrase, the fetishism of commodities.